Thank you for those, excuse me, very kind words of introduction. Professor Chandran doesn't know that I actually spent 8 years in Northeast England. I grew up in Darlington with Swedish family, and this is a fond return to Edinburgh. I've been here a few times, but I remember as a child coming here with my family some 40, 42 years ago maybe, and I was here with my father and my mother, and my father had Parkinson's disease. And he, although he passed away 20 years ago, he remains a great source of inspiration. So standing in front of all of you who are here tonight, many of you affected by Parkinson's disease, you're sort of bringing my father back to life, because I see my father in all of you. You may wonder why I chose this odd title, and if you look at it, it says, "The Battle to Beat Parkinson's Disease, the End of the Beginning." Well, I've been doing this for over 30 years. It took a little bit longer, it seems, than the Second World War, but that's the inspiration. So you know where the quote is coming from. And I really think we are at a very exciting point in the research at the moment with Parkinson's. We don't quite know when the end is going to come, but I think we are in a very, very exciting time now. And I hope at the end of the next 45, 50 minutes, you will share that view with me. I know many of you know a lot about Parkinson's disease, being affected by it as patients or being family members, or I know several of you are healthcare professionals, but I'll still give you a quick review of what happens in the brain in 30 seconds. So the key to the disease, if we're going to simplify it, is that a group of nerve cells that contain dopamine that are in the middle of the brain, in the midbrain, they die progressively and disappear. They're normally pigmented cells, and at the end stage of the disease, all of this pigment is gone as the cells are gone. As you heard, an integral part of the disease process is the formation of Lewy bodies, and these are protein clumps. Here you can see such a clump that forms in nerve cells, and we have learned that these protein clumps are found in certain brain regions. I'm going to get back to this in a minute, and then spread throughout the brain. So after 20 to 30 years of disease, you'll find these protein clumps all over the place. So while we think the death of the dopamine-producing nerve cells is important for the motor symptoms, the inability to move, these protein clumps are probably important for other aspects of the disease that I will talk about in a while. So that was more than 30 seconds. Let me tell you what I'm going to talk about for the rest of my presentation. I want to start by really starting in this room and saying we need to understand what the needs are, the unmet medical needs that are most urgent in Parkinson's, and we need to share that knowledge with each other. I'll do that very briefly. Then I'm going to describe some of the work that was alluded to before, using cells to repair the brain, or using genes to repair the brain. You can imagine that's actually possible today, gene therapy. I will then discuss the need for having the right experimental models. As you will understand from my presentation, one of the reasons we're still fighting this battle with Parkinson's disease and haven't licked the disease in just 6 years, like the Second World War, is that we may not have had the right models, and maybe we're getting them now. Then I will describe something called drug repurposing, and I hopefully will convince you that this is an interesting alternative, a parallel track to the classical way of developing drugs, and you'll soon understand what I mean by this. It certainly can be cheaper and probably faster. We don't know if it's better. Finally, I'm going to talk about something called rallying to the challenge, and I'll keep you in suspense until the end to know before I tell you what that is. Understanding unmet medical needs in Parkinson's disease is very important, so the research isn't focused on the wrong thing. And you had Professor Ray Chowdhury here a couple of years ago. He pioneered the understanding of non-motor symptoms in Parkinson's disease. And that's been a very important development. When my father was ill, nobody ever talked about non-motor symptoms. We sort of noticed them and knew they were there, but they were not in the textbooks. One of the best descriptions of the unmet medical needs in Parkinson's disease was given by Tom Isaacs, who is one of the founders of the Cure Parkinson's Trust, and he himself is affected by the disease. He gave the talk at a meeting called Grand Challenges in Parkinson's Disease that we held in Grand Rapids in September last year. And I urge all of you to go and look at this web link. I realize it's impossible to take notes with that strange code there, but I'm sure through the help of Parkinson's UK, we can make this available. It's on YouTube. Because he really, in a most eloquent manner, describes the journey, the Parkinson's journey through seven phases, and illustrates that the needs are different in the early phase. The second phase, when you realize you have the disease and you accept you have it. And he walks through these different phases. And in advanced disease, of course, the needs are completely different to those in the early stages. And I have never really heard anyone describe it so well as he did. But I will give you a sort of doctor's version of what he said, not as personal, not as eloquent. But I think it's fair to say that today the dopaminergic therapies that we have access to, they are good for the motor symptoms for several years. Now, it's still an issue that virtually all patients get involuntary movements, dyskinesias, but we are better at handling this than we were 20, 30 years ago and better at minimizing these. But still, the dopaminergic therapies are pretty good. What's clear is that there are really no effective therapies for all those non-motor symptoms that you heard about a couple of years ago. And most importantly, I think, there are no therapies that actually slow down the relentless course and the progressive nature of the disease. So this is really the holy grail of Parkinson's research, to find something that will slow down the progression. Now, I'm going to cite another speaker who was here then in 2012, Roger Barker, when it comes to understanding what we need to target in terms of slowing down the disease. What are the primary symptoms we want to get at? And he describes this in a very good paper together with Jonathan Evans, where they discuss meaningful outcome measures in trials of disease-modifying therapies. And disease-modifying therapies are those that slow down the progression. And what they discuss is that there are different problems in different phases, a bit like Tom Isaacs described, but they're not describing it from the patient perspective. And in this diagram, you'll see that they emphasize that postural instability and motor fluctuations are the things that come within the first 5 to 12 years of diagnosis. And it's in this area that we may be able to offer strategies where we repair the brain. We can probably avoid postural instability and motor fluctuations using two strategies. One is to put in new cells in the brain, and the other one is, as I'll tell you soon, using gene therapy. But let's look at this concept of using new cells to repair the brain. And this is where I come from in my background. I started with this when I was, 19, back in the early 80s. So in Sweden, between 1987 and 1999, we performed trials in 18 patients. We conducted over 30 surgeries because some of these patients received transplants on both sides of their brain. What did we transplant? Well, we took immature dopamine neurons, the ones that are particularly vulnerable in Parkinson's disease, and we took these from embryos at a very, very early stage. We had to use a fine microscope and watchmaker's forceps to get them out of there. And then we put them in a test tube, and our neurosurgeon, Stig Grenkrona, injected these cells into the depth of the brain of the patient with Parkinson's disease. This happens to be the very first surgery we did in 1987, the one that you're seeing in the picture there. Now, to cut a very long story short, it's a 28-year long story, I can say that in about a third of these patients, the transplants had tremendous effects. In about a third of them, it had moderately good effects, and in about a third of them, we really didn't see anything. And that was, in some cases, for reasons that we've subsequently understood were bad technique, something with the instrument that wasn't good, etc. And perhaps in one case, the diagnosis wasn't really appropriate. It wasn't proper real Parkinson's disease. But when we did well, the outcome has been really remarkable, as I said. And we've followed a couple of these patients now for up to close to 20 years. And these two patients, although they were operated in Sweden, they happened to be British patients who flew over to Lund and had the surgery there. And these are patients 7 and 15 in the series of 18 patients. And I'll show you some data of them showing their functional benefit, their improvement, over, in this case, 18 years after surgery. And you can see on this part of the diagram, we rate how poorly the patient is doing. So a high score here means that they're very ill. And this patient was about 10 years into his disease when he got his first transplant. And we can see after one transplant, he improved. He got a second transplant here after about another 1 or 2 years. And then he got down to a level where he wasn't quite normal, but he managed to do his normal activity, daily of living activities without any help. And he didn't need any L-DOPA medication anymore. And he's stayed like this for the full observation period that we followed him. And patient 15 is essentially similar. He wasn't quite as severely affected when we did the surgery. And you can see that he's down at a level where he's not taking any L-DOPA and has been doing very, very well. Now remember, and I'm showing you the video of patient number 7 first, remember that these patients, in the latter videos you're going to see, they are some 28, 29 years after diagnosis. That is a very long time. Remember, they are without medication. So here's patient 7 now, before surgery, trying to do a simple finger tapping test. And he's struggling, as you see. You can barely see any movement towards the end of the task here. So this was shot in the early 90s. And here he is 18 years later, no medication. And you can actually see that the transplant is causing a little bit of involuntary movement. He had a lot of dyskinesias on L-DOPA. Here's patient 15, 15 years after surgery, no medication, about 29 years after diagnosis. And I think you'll appreciate that this is quite remarkable. So it is possible to use immature brain cells, inject them with a fine needle into the brain, transplant them, and they will reconnect with the brain, and they will take over the functions that the cells that have died used to have. Now, why are we not doing this anymore? Well, we are still doing it at a very slow pace. It's a long story to explain all the intricacies of the science of this, but one of the limiting factors is getting a good and reliable source of cells that's reproducible from one patient to another. For that reason, we are now looking and turning to stem cells. And this is a culture of stem cells that has been converted into brain cells. And all the red cells here are nerve cells, and all the green indicates that those nerve cells are actually producing dopamine. So why do we need these stem cells? Well, the logistics will be easy if we have stem cells, as I will describe to you in a minute. This will be reproducible. The ethics are simpler, especially if we use stem cells derived from adults, as I will show in a minute. And if we can transplant stem cells that come from the patient, him or herself, we don't have to worry about the risk of immune rejection. So these are advantages. And if you look at this schematic diagram, here are the principles. So we've been using immature cells from an embryo where we get the informed consent from the woman undergoing an abortion. She says, I'll donate my embryo. If you can find cells, that's very good if it can help someone. And then we use those cells, I have used them, transplanted them. You've seen those two patients. And now the approach is to start with what's called an embryonic stem cell. And Roger Barker, who was here a couple of years ago, is leading a European project. They're applying for money from the European Union, which I hope they will get, where they're going to use these sorts of cells, convert them into dopamine neurons, and transplant them. And Marlin Palmer, who's a Swedish young stem cell scientist, she is heading up this part of the work and is actually using cells from the Roslin Institute in Edinburgh as starting material. So it's very, very exciting. It has been a long haul to get this to work to the point when clinical trials can now be considered. And it's taken, I would say, about 12 years to get there. We, and I say we as a research community, many people have been involved in this, started around 2001. Now, you may remember in 2001, the United States banned the use of embryonic stem cells because they're ethically controversial. And I'm going to get back to this in a minute. But for the time being, I'll just say that they're the easiest ones right now to use and get dopamine neurons. And to show you how great those neurons can look, here is a very recent publication from Marlin Palmer, who was here a week ago visiting, where she shows a side-by-side comparison with the sort of fetal cells that are in those two patients and embryonic stem cells. And she's compared this now in rats, so the experimental animals. And if you look at them in the microscope, here's a transplant of embryonic stem cell-derived dopamine neurons. They're very, very similar. If you start with this material, you can't really see many differences. And they have an incredible growth capacity. So these microscopic slides illustrate with a brown color here that they can grow for very long distances, which is excellent. But they are coupled to this ethical controversy, and we have to respect this, that not all cultures like the idea of starting with an embryonic stem cell. This is a discarded embryo from an in vitro fertilization. For that reason, it's important to have alternate strategies for those individuals or cultures or countries that don't accept that approach. And here we are very lucky, because Dr. Yamanaka, the father of the iPS cell, made an absolutely remarkable discovery, which will lead to an absolutely remarkable recovery down the road. His discovery was made in 2006. And it's so remarkable that he shared the Nobel Prize with Sir John Gurdon in 2012, the Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine. So what was the discovery? Well, he showed that you don't have to start with an embryonic stem cell. He's actually started with patient biopsies from the skin, ethically uncontroversial. And then with some genetic engineering, using these own cells, he's been able to reprogram them and change them. So they no longer act and function as adult cells or skin cells. They become what we call induced pluripotent stem cells, very much equivalent to this sort of cell over here. And they're also possible to make into dopamine neurons, which can then be transplanted to the brain. And we know that in Japan, there will be a clinical trial probably within 2 years, possibly even within a year, using this approach. So it's an alternate approach, and hopefully we'll have a similar successful outcome. And here in Edinburgh, Thilo Kunath, whom I visited earlier today, is also doing some pioneering work with this sort of cell source for cell replacement and to model disease, because you can take them from the patients and look at these cells and see if they behave in a different way than if they're taken from someone who doesn't have a disease. Now, science sometimes goes in directions that you can never predict. And I must say, this whole idea that this is possible, if you'd asked me 15 years ago, I'd say, nah, it's never going to work. I mean, you could imagine that you could try, but it's never going to work. But the next step, which was shown just a few years ago now, some 5 years ago, is even more remarkable. What has been shown recently is that you can take the skin fibroblasts here and you can reprogram them so they become dopamine neurons directly. So these are called induced neurons. So they don't even go via the stem cell step. So just think about this. The cell